I think this is the last time we're due to meet before Tisha B'Av and the summer break. So let's try to look at the... let's try to put our heads into the difficult subject of the destruction of the temple, the Beis HaMikdash, which is really what today, which is Rosh Chodesh, is beginning the celebration, I guess, in a negative sense, of the 9 days that lead up to the 9th of Av, which is the time of destruction. We want to try to understand as best we can the subject of the destruction and what it means to us. What is our... See if we can put our finger on a central issue here, and by that step, begin at least the process of rebuilding. The Talmud says, the Gemara says, that when the temple was destroyed, the second temple was destroyed, there's an extremely strange incident that occurred during that destruction. The Roman general who was leading that particular campaign was Titus, Titus Arosha. And the Gemara says that when he entered the sanctuary, when he entered the temple, he approached the Holy of Holies, the Kodesh Kodashim, and he put his sword through the parochas, the curtain that hangs. There's a debate in the Talmud about whether it was one layer thick, the curtain, or two layers, according to one opinion. There was one thickness of curtain, according to another. There were actually two layers of curtain. One opened on the south, and one opened on the north, so that you had to walk in and between them. That's how the Kohen Gadol walked into the Kodesh Kodashim. There was one Amma between them. But be that as it may, this, whatever it was, this, let's say, curtain separating the innermost zone, the innermost sanctum, the Kodesh Kodashim, that place where the high priest, the Kohen Gadol, goes only he and only once a year in Yom Kippur, in which is contained the Aron, the Ark. Strictly speaking, the Aron was not contained in it then because it had already been hidden, knowing that the destruction would come already before the destruction of the first temple. Yoshiyahu HaMelech, the king, Yoshiyahu hid it in hidden underground caverns somewhere in the area of the Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, and therefore the original Aron was not there. Also, the golden kruvim, the golden angels that were cast in one piece with the covering of the Aron, those original ones were not there. What was there was the two big ones that had been placed there by Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon. But that Holy of Holies, that Kodesh Kodashim, that is beyond space and time, that inner place from which all spirituality and all essence, really, the essence of all existence, really, emanates. You know that the our sources indicate that inside that place, there is no dimension of space and time. There's a transcendence in there which is... In fact, a correct understanding of that makes it almost impossible for us to understand how any human being could have walked in there. You know, the Gemara says that the world is built in concentric layers of Kedusha, concentric layers or circles, if you like, zones of sanctity, of elevation. The whole world is built on one level. Israel, land of Israel, is another level. It has a certain transcendent nature. That space there, the very notion of space there, is not the same as it is elsewhere. One indication of that is that the land will never be too small, no matter how many of her children come home. Right? It's called Eretz Tzvi. Tzvi is an animal whose skin, when removed, does not appear to be large enough to cover its body. Israel is like that, right? Like a mother's home stretches no matter how many children come home. But when you move from the outer areas of Israel to Yerushalayim, when you move into Yerushalayim, then you come to a place which is another precinct, it's another level of Kedusha. There, for example, the Gemara says that, the Mishnah actually says that no one ever said that I tsar li hamakim lalun b'Yerushalayim. No one ever said that he couldn't find comfortable lodging in Yerushalayim. No matter how many people came to Yerushalayim during the pilgrim festivals, the Aliyah LeRegel, no one ever said that they couldn't find a place. It doesn't just mean, there's a deep issue here. It means that Yerushalayim is elevated. It transcends the normal rules of space. It transcends even the normal rules of space that are already transcended in the rest of Israel. And then if you move further in, if you move into the Azara, you move into the courtyard area of the temple, when you move up another layer, so there you already get into the zone of miracles. There it says, for example, Omdim Svufim, that people there used to stand crushed, Umishtachavim Revochim, but they used to bow down with plenty of space. There, when there came time for all the people to bow, they were standing compressed shoulder to shoulder, and yet when they had to prostrate themselves on the ground, there was plenty of room around each person. That of course, is miraculous, right? People occupy the least ground space when they're standing. When they lie down, you occupy much more. And yet, miraculously, when they stood, there was constraint, and when they lay down, there was space. Of course, there's another message here, too, and that is when you stand on your own feet. I mean, there's a spiritual message, of course, in all of this, not only a, let's say, a Kabbalistic idea. The message here, of course, is that when you stand on your own feet, which means the assertion of your own selfhood, so then we rub shoulders, in other words. Then there's not much, you don't have much space. But when you prostrate yourself, when you bow, that means you annul who you are as an individual, then there's no problem with conflict with others. That means in the position of humility, that's how it is. When you assert yourself, then there's friction with others asserting themselves. When no one is concerned with asserting themselves as an individual independent of others, then there's space everyone. But nevertheless, that's the physical facts were like that. But when you move further in and you go to the Kodesh Kodashim, in the Holy of Holies, so to speak, there was no element of space at all. There you have, for example, it says there that the space measured from wall to wall was exactly the same space as if you measured from the Aron itself. In other words, the Aron, the Ark, the Holy Ark, had certain dimensions. And yet, if you included those dimensions, or you didn't include them, right? It's called Aron, Makam Aron Eno Min Amida. The place where the Aron stands has no measurement. That means you have to understand, it does not mean, it means you could fit it inside and it occupied no space. And do not think for a moment that it means that the building stretched or that the Aron shrank. It doesn't mean that. If the Aron would have shrank less than its halachic measurements, it would have been invalid. Right? It could not shrink. It had to be its standard measurement. If, however, the building, the room, expanded, it would also be invalid. Because the measurements of the temple are very very specific. They have to be exactly what they have to be. So you have this contradiction in terms. You have this room, this sanctum, which has particular measurements, and inside is an Aron, an object which has its measurements. You put that inside, one inside the other, and it takes no space. And the reason is because here you stand at the center of the universe, where space itself is being created. In fact, the Mishnah says that when the Aron was taken away, what was left there was a stone raised only 3 fingers above the ground, which is known as the Even Shasia. Even Shasia means the rock of formation. Today you know where that rock is. You know where that rock is today. You know what stands above it today. Nevertheless, that's where it is. That is the stone which was the Even Shasia, the rock on which the world, the expansion of space began, in fact, begins there. Also the rock on which Isaac Yitzchak was sacrificed. Right? This is the place where space itself comes into existence, and therefore at that place of junction between the world that is beyond space and time and the world of space and time, the rules there don't apply. Just like in the first 6 days of creation, the rules of nature don't apply in those 6 days because those are the 6 days during which the rules come into formation. And you can't apply the rules of a system back in the phase when the rules themselves were being formed. Similarly, in the zone of creation where space begins to be formed, so there you have space being formed, but it's not subject to the rules of space. Into that inner place, which is completely transcendent, which is beyond this world, the only place in which the name, the divine name, can be pronounced openly in this world. That name cannot be said in this world because it's a name that is beyond the world. It's a name that indicates. It is the name of a world that is not this world. That's why we never say that world. We never say that word with our mouths. Whenever we come across that word and it needs to be said, we transpose another word for it, right? Instead of saying Yudke Vavke, we never pronounce that word. We say Adoi, right? We say the name Adonis. We don't say Yudke Vavke. We read it with our eyes, but we don't pronounce that word. And the reason is because that is the name of a world that is not this world. And if it would be set in this world, it would be brought down and compressed and distorted and constrained by the dimensions of this world. And so we don't say it. The mind can hold it because the mind is capable. There's an inner zone in the mind, which is what exactly what I'd like to try and discuss this evening. There's an inner zone in the mind where that can live. But the mouth, which is a physical organ, which must say a finite word in the world, that word cannot be said. It would be a distortion and a misrepresentation of what that word means to say it in the world. But there's one place in the world where it can be said, inside the Kodesh Kodashim. Because that place is a place of another world. That is a place which is beyond time and space. That is the Kodesh Kodashim. Now when the temple was destroyed and the Kedusha left, so he, in sacking the Beis HaMikdash, before they set fire to it, he ran in and he put his sword through the Pareches. In other words, first of all, let's just say a word of introduction here. You have to understand that these people are not, we're not discussing fools and inconsequential people. We're talking about a man who knew that the battle against the Jews is a spiritual battle. He may have manifested that battle. The manifestation of that battle was, no doubt, was no question, was a physical battle. There was an attack and there was a sacking of the city and there was a burning of the Beis HaMikdash. But in fact, the battle was a spiritual battle. The Gemara says there that kimchat chinas tachan, that means you ground wheat. That means when he sacked the Beis HaMikdash, the expression there, the Talmudic expression is that he was grinding wheat that had already been ground. In other words, since the spirituality had left, he was able to destroy the building. That building is not subject to being destroyed. The Beis HaMikdash, the temple, can only be destroyed when it's only the corpse of a building. When the soul has left, then the body could be desecrated. But while the soul was yet there, while Hashem was in it, then no non-Jew could destroy that building. He was only able to destroy the building once its Kedusha had left, right? Like a corpse. And that had left because of us, not because of them. Right? The Nefesh HaChaim explains very clearly that soul of the world had left the world because we had exiled that soul. That's up to us and not up to the non-Jews. But the non-Jews can come in and find no defenses when we've done that. And then he was able to come in and he was dealing with an empty building. A building that was only, was already in its mode of spiritual destruction. All that remained was the stones and the wood. And he was coming in to grind wheat that, unknown to him, in fact, had already been ground by us. That's the expression. Nevertheless, in that act of destruction, which he knew was a spiritual battle, on the contrary, the Gemara says that the discussion he went through beforehand sounds bizarre to us. But he said, how am I going to destroy these people? These people are protected by the divine, by Hashem himself. And one does not destroy the Jewish people unless you deal with their source. And he made a whole plan. If I deal with him, if I battle with the spiritual source in the medium of water, on the ocean, he'll beat me. Because he destroyed the Egyptians in the ocean. I have to deal with him on the land. And a whole battle, a plan, a strategy, how he was going to deal, not with the Jewish people, but with our patron, as it were, right? Our spiritual source. So there's no question that he understood that this was a spiritual issue. You don't destroy the Jewish people by plotting against them strategically, when the source of all existence is behind us. You have to weaken us spiritually, you have to... So when that occurred, and he found himself in that situation, he ran into the Kodesh Kodashim, and he put his sword through the Pareches, and blood poured out. Blood. Blood came out of the curtain. That's what you call a nes lara. It means a miracle on the dark side. Right? A miracle on the dark side, a nes. A nes lara. It's not the only one that occurred. Another one that occurred was that the two golden angels, the two golden kruvim, which were male and female in their form, and ideally should have been embracing, because that inner sanctum is the place of intimate meeting. That is the place of intimate meeting of Hashem and us, the ultimate husband, the ultimate wife in the world, the ultimate form of man and woman, is the divine source, as it were, and the ultimate human reflection of that source, which is the Jewish people, that ultimate bride. That is the place of their meeting. That's why the temple is called Asra de Nashki, Shmai of Arad, a place where heaven and earth kiss. Right? That metaphor is chosen carefully. It's because there's a place of intimate contact. That's what it is. And these two golden kruvim, they would miraculously embrace each other, turn towards each other when our relationship with Hashem was the way it should be, although they were inanimate objects. And when our relationship with Him was not the way it should be, they would turn away. And when the Jewish people used to come, Aliyah LeRegel, there was a lifting of the curtain, they could see in what situation our relationship was, like an indicator of our relationship. And at that moment of destruction, when the Romans destroyed the building, they took these two golden kruvim and they dragged them in the streets. In order to humiliate the Jewish people, and make that destruction complete, they paraded those images in the street, and of course at that time they were embracing. They were locked in an embrace. The Romans used it for even more negativity. They said, look what the Jews have in their holiest sanctum, look what they have. They have here an image of male and female, right, in contact. That's what they... Nevertheless, the question we have to deal with is why they were at that time locked in an embrace. Surely there's no greater time of distance between Hashem and us. On the contrary, the Medrash says that our closeness with Hashem was never greater than during our time in the desert. When we marched through the desert, there the Medrash says, the beautiful image of man and woman in a perfect marriage, there the Medrash puts it like this. It says, when our love was strong, we lay together on the blade of a knife. Meaning that in the Mishkan, that place of meeting of the Jewish people and Hashem during our years in the desert, there was the closeness between a newly wed couple, as it were, where no matter how closely they are confined, right, it's not a problem. It's not a problem. The marriage is young, and that's ideal. So we lay together on the blade of a knife. But later, when the Medrash says we went into Israel, there already it's a natural land. It's not only a spiritual relationship, it's also a relationship of natural effort and tilling the land and so forth. That introduces a level of decreased intensity. Then it says a bed of 60 cubits was already too small. Right? Which means that this couple, the marriage is not what it once was. And there's a distance. And finally, in this phase of the world's history, the second temple, of course, was twice the size of the first. As we're going down in the generations and we need more, that small constraint where the intensity is greatest is no longer there. And finally, when the second temple was destroyed, the expression that's used there in the Medrash is HaShemayim Kisi Va'aretz Hodom Raglai, the heavens are my throne and the earth is my footstool. In other words, now the separation is not a knife blade and it's not a bed of 60 amos. It is now a heaven and earth separation. And that is the situation of explosive division, which is what we find ourselves in. Despite that, at that moment of explosion where the parties are being, as it were, banished from each other, at that moment the golden kruvim were embracing. Right? That was also a miraculous revelation. What does it mean? It's not directly our subject. What it means is many things. One of the things it means is that in that moment of destruction is actually a love being manifest. That also needs explanation. How is love being manifest at a time of discipline? How is the discipline or the punishment that's being wrought at that moment, how in fact it is an act of love? Needs discussion. And another explanation also is that these angels faced each other when they were an indicator of our relationship with Hashem. But that's not when they were exposed to non-Jewish eyes. When exposed to the eyes of the non-Jews, at that moment, even the greatest distance between him and us, right, is still the most compared to, that means, understanding our place in history and how we are supposed to be the ones. We are supposed to be the ones who bear that relationship and bring it into the world. So our relationship with him is a relationship of intensity. Our role in history means that we bond ourselves into that relationship, and even at the moment of greatest separation, relative to the world, that's a tremendous intensity. Relative to outside eyes, relative to inside eyes, it would have been the greatest separation. But paraded in the streets before the non-Jewish eyes, that's a time of intensity. This is not our subject directly. But let's return to the nace that we're discussing. He put his sword through the pareches, and blood came out. As if to say, the heart of the world had been pierced. The heart of the world... And then the Gemara says a remarkable thing. Sava sheharages atzmoi. He thought he had killed. Right? And then comes a very difficult word. The word is atzmoi. That word literally means himself. Now the Gemara doesn't mean himself. What it means is he thought he had killed the one who dwells in that inner sanctum, normally. Right? Whose blood, as it were, he imagined he was... talking about a supreme degree of megalomania beyond all description. But nevertheless, a person who actually stood at that point in history, actually was the agent. He was the agent. True, it was ground wheat. And true, it was a dead lion that was slain, as the sources put it. It was a lion that had already been... But nevertheless, he was the one who did that. And he thought that he had killed... How could you assume such a thing? How could you imagine that you could kill the source of existence itself? So if you have a big enough opinion of yourself, big enough, then you could think that. But what we need to focus on is a particular angle here, nuance in that expression. When the expression is used, Savash Haragas Atzmoi, he thought he had killed himself. The meaning there, there's a dual meaning. The simple meaning is that there's certain things the mouth cannot utter. And when we need to say things like that, the Torah expression is to employ a euphemism. Employ euphemism. There are times in the Talmud, for example, where a discussion is taking place between two people, and there's the second person who's being used. You, and you, and you, and you. Then there comes in the moment when one utters a curse. Right? But instead of saying you in the term of the curse, the Talmud suddenly switches into the third person. Because we don't even wish to utter from our mouths a statement as if one is saying to another. So we employ euphemism. Another classic example would be sometimes when the Talmud talks about events that should have caused the ultimate destruction of the Jewish people. So there the expression is, Hayu ye mechay, it would have been chayev, that means obligated, soineim shel Yisrael klai, that means the enemies of the Jewish people would have deserved destruction. It doesn't mean the enemies, it means us. But how can you say that from your mouth, talk about the destruction of, and therefore we substitute a term which is the opposite of what we mean, right? Opposite of what we mean. The classic expression of the Talmud is called Sagi Nahor. Sagi Nahor means, it's referring to a person who cannot see, and Sagi Nahor means plenty of light. Much light, right? For a person who is in darkness. So the simple explanation here is, you cannot utter from your mouth the expression that he thought he had killed, right, the one whom you cannot say. So therefore we substitute a word, Savash Haragas Atzmo, himself. That's the simple explanation. But there's something much deeper here, much deeper. And that is that all these words, words of Torah, they must be deeply true. These are not simply... We do not employ a word that is euphemistic reference to something which in fact indicates the opposite. At some level it has its own truth. What does it mean that there was a killing of the self? What does that mean? What does that mean? So let's try and put our heads into this difficult subject, very difficult subject, but the reason it is as difficult as it is because we are in a situation of destruction. So this energy, this thing that we need to understand is beyond us. The real mourning here should be for the fact that we're not even capable of mourning. Because that which is left, we're so out of touch with it, we don't even know we've lost it. That's the cause of real sadness. On the contrary, all the sources say that the only hope of the rebuilding of Yerushalayim, if there's someone around to mourn, the only rejoicing, if you want to rejoice in the rebuilding, the only kind of person who can rejoice in the reconvening of a relationship is one who felt the loss of the relationship when it disappeared in the first place. Right? If in a deep, intimate relationship, a person is lost. So the one who shared that relationship mourns intensely. Someone who's not related to that person may, shed an occasional tear. And someone who doesn't even know the person, not even... So when the person comes back after many years separation, so the ecstasy is felt by the one who had the loss. The person who shed a tear may, evince a smile. And the person who never knew that they left in the first place, completely unmoved when they return. Right? That's why it says, rejoice all those who mourn for Yerushalayim. And we are in the really unenviable situation of not even being able to mourn. We are like that person who doesn't even know, didn't even notice when it left. And the reason is because of this particular problem. So let's try and put our heads into this. What does it mean, death of the self? Because you and I, we live in a post-death of the death of the self world. That's our problem. I'm sorry to have to tell you this. But we live in a world, we are not alive anymore. We have the most important faculty that we have in the mind is no longer with us. Right? Our minds have become sophisticated calculators. Our minds have become calculators. Inner knowledge, real knowledge, that knowledge which our deep sources called Atzmoi, that means you yourself, we're not in touch with. The real destruction, you have to understand this, the real destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, the destruction of the temple means that at that moment, the atzmius of the world, that means the etzem, the essence, the spiritual essence of the world leaves it. And when that essence leaves the world, yours leaves you. The real truth is, it leaves because yours is left. It's because we don't have that inner faculty of knowledge that the world doesn't have that spiritual essence. If we came to our senses and we understood what it really means to know things, right? If we really knew what needs to be known and we knew it with our being, with our atzmius, that means... That would be a rebuilding in itself. What is this faculty of knowledge? What is meant by this? Let's try to in a very clumsy and almost impossible way, but let's at least begin to follow the trail of what it is that's gone missing. There are two kinds of knowledge. Again, difficult subject, right? And the more Western your mind is, the more you've been trained in Western thought, the more impossible, the more difficult this message is. In the East, there's a more natural familiarity with some of these ideas. In the technological, empirical, scientific West, it's very far from our minds. But the truth is that Jewish knowledge and spiritual knowledge, that this is where it lives. And if we're not going to try to pick up at least something of this, there's no, right, we'll never get back there. And it's like this. There are two kinds of knowledge. There are two kinds of knowledge. There's an external knowledge which is technological, and there's an internal knowledge which is spiritual. That internal knowledge is the knowledge of self. The first thing that it grasps is your knowledge of yourself. And of course, the next thing that it grasps is that you are not everything. And that is the first step towards Emunah. The first step towards Emunah, knowing who he is knowing, unlike a child who thinks that the world is all him, is knowing that I am, and I am an essence, but I'm part of a context that is not me. It's the first step beyond the self. And it has to be known with the same faculty that you know yourself. If you want an analogy for this, it's love. Love is something that happens only within the self. Love does not mean that there's a fixing of the self onto something that's non-self. That's not love. Love, you can only really, just as you can only really know yourself, there's nothing else you can know in first-hand terms, you can only love yourself. Love of another does not mean that you love someone else. Real love of another is only existing when you expand yourself so that they become part of you. And then it's love of self again. Again. Real love does not mean that I love you who are separate from me. At the moment that you're separate from me, the Hebrew word ahava means giving myself to you. Hav means giving. And ahava adds up to the same numerical equivalent in Hebrew as the word echad, which means one. Love in Hebrew adds up to 13. And the word echad adds up to 13. Meaning that real love is where there's a oneness. Not a sentimental oneness that we come close. Oneness means that we're in fact one. It's not just in name. One means when my existence is meshed with yours so that we cannot tell the difference at a certain level. And we wouldn't want to tell the difference. And you're as important to me as I am. Then you don't have to talk about generating love. That is there already. Similarly, knowledge of self. The inner knowledge, not the technological external knowledge. The internal knowledge, knowledge of self. You know that because you know it in first-hand terms. You know yourself because you know yourself. You don't know yourself because you can prove it or you can relate to some empirical or scientific proof. Not. The first thing that you know with that inner knowledge is yourself. You know, it's a remarkable thing that you can only really know yourself. The only thing that you know directly is yourself. It's a remarkable thing is that there has to be deep meditation put into this. Anything else that you know in the world, you know through an interface. You only know it through sense data that come in. In modern philosophy, they call this the sense data problem. I only know that you're sitting here because the deep problem, the intractable problem, is that you can only know the world through a second-hand experience. The only reason that I know what this is because it appears to me that I know what this is. But in fact, all I can know of it is what my nerve impulses, what my nerve endings, the sense modality that I employ here tells me about the thing. But I have no way of knowing what it actually is. If I apply another sense, I look at it, so I think I know what it is by seeing. But in fact, all my seeing is a set of physiological phenomena. It's only really light energy that is causing certain changes in certain nerves and a certain stimulation in my brain. So I interpret things in the outer world and I imagine that I know them. But there's no reliability to that knowledge at all. For example, I can't even know that you see it the way I see it. I can't even know that. I cannot know anything directly except what's in my own head. It's the only thing I can know. I can't even know that in your head is a person. I can't know that intimately. You might be a very sophisticated machine. You might be a bunch of transistors, very cleverly programmed. with a very clever plastic skin that has been very subtly... How do I know there's a person in you? I only know it by inference. I only know it because I know what's in me. And when I see certain indications that you have in common with me, I can infer that inside you is somebody like me. But it's all inference. The only thing I ever know in the world, it's a very lonely place to be, but it's the beginning of all knowledge. The only thing I know directly is my, what we call das, is my own inner knowledge. I know who I am because I know who I am. I don't need sense for that, sense data. I don't need sensory phenomena, sensory inputs. I don't need to measure or register that on any machine or any nerve endings. I know it in primary terms. External knowledge cannot do that. Now, let's try and get this clear. There's nothing more important than this. You know, when you go for meditation, if you ever take a meditation class, so the first thing the instructor will tell you is, he will tell you to switch off your mind. They will tell you that meditation involves switching off the mind. If you switch off the mind, that's not meditation. If you switch off the mind, that is becoming a zombie. That's what's, it's very nice and it's very relaxing and no doubt it's healthy and all that, but it's got nothing to do with meditation. Meditation doesn't mean switching off the mind. Meditation means switching on the mind. Why is the instruction to switch off the mind? Because what's meant is to switch off the external mind. The mind that you can control. The mind that is always searching and seeking to prove and to measure and to... That mind can be switched off. And if that mind is effectively switched off, then the inner mind, the real mind, the part of the mind that really knows, can flourish. There's a very deep secret here. The reason that we don't know things genuinely in this generation. We are a hysterical generation. We are a hysterical, wild people. We don't know... We have no time for actually making contact with what we really know. The one thing we're out of touch with is who we really actually are. All we put any faith in is what we can measure. You know, it's an incredible thing. The amazing thing. Let's put it like this. The one who put it perhaps most elegantly for our generation's needs was Rav Dessler. Rav Dessler said like this, there are two parts to the mind. This is the anatomy of the subject. He said there are two parts to the mind. There's the external faculty, what he called a mabat achitzoni. Mabat achitzoni means, mabat means the vision, E-Y-E, the eye, the outer eye, not I, self, E-Y-E, the mabat, the outer look. And then there's a mabat apnimi, the inner look, the inner eye, the inner vision. What's the difference? The inner eye is what we call das, that's real dat, that's real knowledge. Dat, incidentally, means knowledge, and it also means intimate connection. Here we're getting to why this, in the Holy of Holies, in the Kodesh Kodoshim was a place of intimacy, of Hashem meeting us in an intimate fashion, and also genuine knowledge. The word knowledge in Hebrew, das, means marital connection, it means the oneness in marriage, and it means knowledge. What do those two have in common? Because what I know with das is one with me. My knowledge of myself is myself. The deep sources say that if something you know with das turns out to be false, you disappear. If something you know with the external mind turns out to be false, you delete it. But if something you know with the internal mind turns out to be false, you disappear. Well, isn't that obvious? If what the inner mind knows is your own existence and that turns out to be false, who's left? That means there's an intimate connection, a male-female type of connection between you and your inner knowledge. It is not that you know it. It's that it is you and your knowledge. Your knowledge of yourself is yourself. And that's why, of course, this intimacy, it's hard to talk about this in detail, but that's why when the intimacy breaks down, what you're left with is a very vulgar immorality. There's no accident that they connected. I don't have to remind you. You know what the Talmud goes on to say happened after he put his sword through the paroches and blood came out? You know what he did next? He took a prostitute into the Kodesh Kodoshim. Do you understand? That is the ultimate travesty of that, of the purity that should be manifest there. Right? He knew exactly what he was doing. It's no accident that Egypt, which is where we began, is the place of no spiritual knowledge. Mitzrayim is the place. Mitzrayim spells Metzar Yam, the squeezing of the 50th. That means a place where there's a constraint of that which is transcendent knowledge. The 50th level is always the level, what's called Em HaBonim, it's called the ultimate mother, it's the level of connection with the Das. Egypt is the place where they have none of that. Instead of looking up to the heavens for rain, Egypt, unlike Israel, where there's only rain, and you have to look up for it, Mitzrayim is a place where it says, "Vishkita barag lecha kegana yarak." You irrigate the land like a verdant garden with your feet. That means the Nile rises. You don't ever have to look up to the heavens in Egypt. You always look down to the Nile. Right? Disconnection from the spiritual world. Egypt is a place where there's disconnection from spiritual wisdom, and it happens to be that place on earth of the worst sensual immorality. Right? What's called Erev HaSaaretz. What do those two have to do in common? But that's everything. They have everything to do in common. That's all that's left. You see our generation? You look out at our generation. Would you say it's a generation of spiritual wisdom and great sensual control and morality? Is that what you'd say? That's your, over your assessment? Egypt is a place where you lack both of those, and you move from there towards Sinai, which is the ultimate spiritual wisdom and intimate connection. That's exactly what it is. But that's not our discussion, and that's hard to go into the details. But let's focus on the wisdom element. That sort of connection. The outer eye is completely distinct from the inner eye. The outer eye is that which is defined as follows. You see, the way we want to get in touch with our inner knowledge, we can only do it by knowing what the outer is and then saying that this is everything that's not that. Again, there's no way to put, you cannot put in words the inner wisdom. That means your own genuine knowledge, your own das, your own knowledge of yourself cannot be put in words. It cannot be written, it cannot be demonstrated, it cannot be put in words. It can only be known in its own terms, right? You can never express it. How do you talk about it? You can only show what the external is, and then we leave you, me, in our own silent moment to know what's left. So we can say this, the external mind, the mabat achitzoni, that certainly can be discussed. What is the external mind? It is the five senses and the logical computational faculty. That's what it is. It's your five senses, the means by which you interact and you take in readings from the world, and the faculty you have of being able to manipulate that information. In other words, exactly what a machine can do. A calculator, a computer, a machine can make very good, efficient measurements by means of sensory transducers, and then it can calculate with that wisdom. With that information, I can come to conclusions. In fact, a well-put-together machine can do it far better and far faster than you can. That's the Mabat HaChitzoni. The Mabat HaPnimi is what in English you call consciousness. Perhaps the best general word in English is your consciousness of your self-awareness. That no machine has. That no machine has. There's no machine in the world that knows that it is. The only difference between you and a machine, the only essential difference between you and a machine, is that you and the machine can make measurements and calculations. But the difference is that you know that you're doing that. The machine doesn't know. It just does. Animals have a very rudimentary sense of this, extremely rudimentary. So much so that they're in a completely different category of existence. And machines have none of that. That inner knowledge that a machine does not have, no matter how sophisticated the machine is, that is this inner knowledge. Incidentally, how can you know that a machine doesn't have it? How can you know that? You know, the big challenge in artificial intelligence today is to build a machine that will do this. You know that. You know, the big debate that's going on today in artificial intelligence, and it cuts across philosophy and many other areas too, psychology and many other areas, is whether a machine built sophisticated enough would be self-aware. Are you familiar with this debate? The one side of the argument says, of course it would be. That's all the brain is. That's all the brain is. The brain is a set of wires, a very sophisticated, flexible, multiplex tool of wiring put together in such a way that when you switch it on, it not only calculates, it knows it is self-aware, it has consciousness. Therefore, it's absolutely primarily obvious that if you built a machine with the same, it's a little technically difficult to do today because the brain has billions of interconnections, but it's not far off. And therefore, their argument is if you build a machine that has the same number and same sophistication of interconnections, when you switch it on, it will say, good morning. And if you say, do you know what you're saying? The machine would say, definitely. Because the brain is a machine. Therefore, it's absolutely obvious, fundamentally, that if you built a machine with the same... The other school, that's called the strong AI position. The other school says to them, you fellows are raving. You know as well as we do that no matter how many wires you put together and you switch it on, it will never know itself. So then they say to them, and how do you know that? So they say, but, What? You can see that a person is more than a bunch of wires. You know that there's something else. It's called an emergent phenomenon or a transcendent thing. It's something else. So they say, excuse me, where is this something else? So they say, well, it sort of hovers around there. And then they say, you call yourself scientists? Then they get very upset because they are scientists. And of course, you can't put your finger on it. So they say, well, we haven't found it yet, but we'll... In fact, this is a much less tractable problem than you might think. Because the problem is, what will happen one day? Let's just cast our minds into the future. I want to make a small prediction for you. Very soon, maybe next week, somebody's going to build a machine, probably be on Tisha B'Av. Somebody's going to build a machine with enough neural interconnections that when you switch it on, it will in fact say good morning. And I am awake and aware. The problem then will be, does the machine mean that? Or is it just saying that? Can you hear the problem? It's no problem to get a machine programmed to say that it's conscious. The problem is, does that mean it is conscious? It's a trivial problem to program a computer well enough. Today, the technology is not... It's a trivial problem to get it to program itself well enough to purport to be conscious. So, how would you know that it is? Do you know that no one's ever come up with a test? Do you know that no one... The only test that's ever been devised is a famous test that was proposed by a computer genius who lived in this country some decades ago. And his proposal, which has never been bettered, is that the way you perform the test is you put the computer, you put the machine behind a screen so that I cannot see it, and you give me a way of interacting with a computer, a keyboard and a screen, it doesn't matter what, and you let me interact with a computer. If after a long enough interaction, I cannot tell whether what's behind the screen is a person or a machine, it's passed the test. That was his test. But you can see how ridiculous the test is. Because all you need to do is have a machine observe a person long enough and have sophisticated enough programming that it could give all the answers that a machine, that a human's supposed to give. On the contrary, it's easier to simulate a human because humans get things wrong too. All you have to do is get it to refuse to answer a few questions, give a few nasty answers, make a few Freudian slips. You know, it can... It's no problem. So let's say you interacted with this thing for a few hours and you were thoroughly convinced that it's a human. I mean, would that prove that it's... But you know why this test was proposed? Because that position holds that if you could interact with it long enough and not tell whether it's a person or a machine, it would make no difference. Why? Because they start the discussion convinced that you are just a machine. It's obvious to them. You're an accidental evolutionary creature that was once a tapeworm or a chicken or whatever it was. And then sometime later you reach the advanced status of being a gorilla. And now you are whatever you are. So therefore, at which stage did genuine consciousness evolve? It's just an emergent phenomenon that swims around in the neurons. They're clear about that. So to them, consciousness is clearly part. Now let me ask you a question. How do you know that your consciousness is not that? And the answer is, you only know it with your inner knowledge. There's no demonstration of that. The painful and difficult news is, you have to swallow this, the painful and difficult news is that all the most important things in life, and the one we want to talk about is faith, knowledge of Hashem's existence, are only known in the inner mind. They are only known in the inner mind. The most important thing that's known with the inner mind is that you are. Do you know that in all the history of human philosophy, there's never been a convincing demonstration of the fact that I exist? Do you know that? The closest anyone's ever come was the proposal, I think, therefore I am. But you know what that statement really means in depth? It means, I know that I am, that's why I am, and that's right. But there's no formal... There was a philosophy professor once who lectured to his class, and he told the students, the first year philosophy students, that there's no formal demonstration that you exist. So one of the students was extremely distressed, extremely distressed. And a week later, the student came back and said, Professor, I've been worrying all week. You have to tell me, do I exist? So the professor said, and who wishes to know? There's no demonstration that you exist. You either know it or you don't. And if you don't know it, you're in very big trouble. Very, very big psychological trouble. If you have doubts about your existence, you're in big trouble. It's that which you know in primary terms. It doesn't need proof. But it's the only thing you know directly. It's the only thing you know through no sensory experience. If you were put in a place deprived of all sensory input, if you couldn't feel, see, taste, touch, hear, do you think you wouldn't know that you exist? Of course you'd know. You know that you are because you know. And all the most important things in life you know only because you know them directly. How do you know, incidentally, how do you know that you're awake? I mean, those of you who are. How do you know? How do you know that you're awake? It's a serious question, this. Think about it for a moment. Close your eyes and ask yourself, am I awake or dreaming? If you decide that you're awake, let me ask you a question. How do you know that you're awake right now? Well, if you tell me, well, I know I'm awake. Yeah, one moment. When you dream, you also think you're awake. When you dream, right? Not the kind of dream where you're aware you're dreaming. You have that also sometimes. But in a dream where you think that you're awake. On the contrary, the reason that you're so terrified in that sort of a dream, right? You can go through dreams in which you can experience abject terror. The reason that you're that terrified is because you're convinced you're... If you knew you were sleeping, you wouldn't be terrified. So when you were dreaming, you were convinced that you were awake. Now that you're awake, you know that you're awake. So excuse me, how do you know you're awake now? Let me ask you a question. Do you know you're awake? How do you know? The answer is, you know, when you go through a dream, in that experience, you're awake and you're absolutely terrified. You're about to be torn limb from limb, whatever it is. And suddenly, at the critical moment, you sit up in bed shaking and sweating and you say to yourself, thank God, Baruch Hashem, that was only a dream. And now I'm awake. Are you sure? How can you be sure? The answer is because your das, your consciousness, your inner knowledge of self tells you those things about yourself. It tells you that you are, that you're alive, that you're awake. It also tells you that you're human and not an animal. How do you know that it's different to kill a person than killing an animal? How do you know that? You cannot know it with your external mind. If you start analyzing it logically, externally, it's a very thin line. There's no way you can prove to yourself that you're awake, because any of the proofs that you could sense now, you could be dreaming too. There is no proof. The inner knowledge things, the things that you know with your das, with your inner knowledge, with your mabata panimi, you only know them in first level terms, first hand terms. You can't, they're not amenable to external demonstration. How do you know you're Jewish? Think about that. How do you know you're Jewish? Is it a pure historical input? How do you know you're a man? Or a woman? Inwardly. How do you know that? How do you know you have free choice? How do you know that when you stand agonizing about a decision that you could go either way? You know, the scientist doesn't necessarily accept that. The formal scientific approach might well be that you're just acting out the constellation. All that the constellation of all your inputs generates is that particular output. Even the fact that you think about it and worry about it, it's all conditioned. You can never convince the scientist who takes that argument, takes that position. You can never convince. You only know, you either know it or you don't. And when you get to transcendent phenomena like infinity, or the infinitesimal that we call the present, you can only know that with the das. You know the present, scientifically, there's no meaning to that. You know that? The concept of the present, the concept of now, let me ask you a question. When do you live? In the past, the present, or the future? In the present, there's no question. Not only that, but the past isn't. The past is not. And the future certainly is not. But do you know that the concept of the present is unsupportable scientifically? The notion of the present is an infinitesimal slipping of the past into the future. It has no meshech, no time, no... So where are you? Where are you? In scientific, rigorously scientific terms, it's a very difficult concept to deal with. But your inner mind has no problem with it. These two, the inner and the outer faculty, are locked in battle. They are opposite modes of knowledge. They meet and focus on the same issues from different perspectives, and they cannot be brought into direct contact. Rabbi Dessler put it very beautifully, and this is worth remembering. He said that the mabata chitzoni, the outer eye, is like a camera. A camera can take a picture of anything in the world except the camera. Every time you try and get that outer logical measuring faculty to look at the inner mind, it snaps. You have to break the camera to do that. And the problem with our minds is we want to access that very precious inner zone of our own knowledge of ourselves and our knowledge of Hashem. But the only way we've been taught to do it is with the external mind. And it keeps breaking and we'll never find a proof. And that's the truth. There is no proof. You never find it. Because the external mind cannot look inwardly. You can't turn that camera around and take a picture of the inside of the camera. You can't do that. That has to be approached on its own terms. Incidentally, when you go to a seminar where they prove to you that God exists, you go to one of these seminars where they prove to you with all these scientific demonstrations that Hashem exists, and some people walk out of there totally bamboozled and absolutely fanatically, cultishly, fiendishly religious. That is not a genuine experience. What those proofs do is, they're very important in bringing you to a logical position where you acknowledge that what you're familiar with is not all that there is. That is a perfectly kosher enterprise. All our great authorities do that. They all engage in what we call chakiris, logical examinations from a purely empirical scientific perspective of whether God exists or not. It's a perfectly legitimate exercise. But all you can ever do, should never misunderstand, all you can ever do with that exercise is demonstrate to yourself that the world as an independent random proposition is very hard to support. That's all. Which leads you to the position that it's very likely that there's something out there. But what that something is out there, you cannot approach except in its own terms. The only place that knowledge of Hashem exists is in that same inner faculty where you know that you are. And that is the secret reason why one of the divine names is the word Ani. The word Ani in Hebrew means I, and it's one of the divine names. What does that mean? It means that the beginning of consciousness of Hashem, of God consciousness, the beginning of that faculty begins in the same place that the word I in its deepest sense. Can you begin to get of a feel for what it means that he put his sword through the paroiches and it says, Sava Sheharag es Atzmoy? That means the I of the world, the sense of I, of what it is to be, to know my own existence. And when that died, we became people who are measuring tools. That's what we are now. We're calculating. We don't have a rich confidence in our own inner knowledge. Right? On the contrary, we get very uncomfortable when we're alone with that. And our first instinct, as soon as we get into that mode where we actually know something, there are rare moments in life where we actually know something, we immediately snap into the external mind and say, can you prove that? Can you measure that? And then you get disappointed again. Whereas the training here has to be to live in that inner moment. When you get in touch with yourself and you actually experience who you are, the wrong response there is to say, can you prove this? Let's measure. You're trying to turn the camera inside. You know, I give you a remarkable example. The Gemara says that nowadays prophecy lives in only three places. Just choosing an example. It's a lengthy discussion. Nowadays you have prophecy in three places only. Children, dogs, and insane people. That's where you now have vestiges of prophecy, right? Children, too young to speak. Animals in general. Actually, the Gemara says that the coming of the Mashiach will be heard in the braying of an ox. Yeah, the Midrash says, actually the Gemara brings it, that there was a Jew plowing with an ox and an Arab. The Maharal talks about this, worth looking up. An Arab was walking past and he said to the Jew, who are you? So the Jew said, I'm a Jew. Yehudiani, yeah, Yehudai, I'm a Jew. So the Arab said to him, your temple has been destroyed. So the Jew said to him, how did you know? He said, I heard it in the voice of your ox. And then he said, break up your team, stop plowing, break it up, your temple's been destroyed. A moment later, the ox bellowed again. So the Arab said to him, hook it up and carry on, the Messiah's been born. He's been born in the house of an Arab in Bethlehem. You look it up yourself, it's fascinating, it's in the Netzach, Chavav. He's been born in an Arab home in Beit Lechem. The Maharal goes into this, what Yishmael, what the Arabs will have to do with the coming of Mashiach, and how they will be the B'nai Yishmael. This is not our subject, we have to talk about it another time. But in case you want to know whether the Torah connects with the headlines, right? The Maharal wrote this 400 years ago, right? The Maharal wrote this commentary 400 years ago about what part the Islamic world will play in the pre-Messianic months, based on this Gemara. But anyway, that's not the point. The point is, that will happen. That's got nothing to do with you and me. What's got to do with you and me is what's in here. So let's focus on that. How did he hear it in the voice of an animal? Because animals have this knowledge. Dogs have it in particular. So you have children, dogs, and insane people. Let me ask you a question. Why are they so connected to spiritual knowledge? What is in common? Let's ask a question for a moment. What is in common between insane people, completely insane, animals, and little children? What's in common? You know what's in common? All three of those have defective mabat chitzonis. That's what's defective. They have no outer, they do not have a cogent, cohesive outer mind. And therefore, there's nothing interfering with the inner mind. Those are three categories of being. You understand what's going on? Those are three categories of being in the world who are clear. The inner mind is clear. Unfortunately, there's no method of communicating because the outer mind that's required to digest it into words and communicate is not functioning. But the reason that they have that inner connection is because that outer mind, that faculty, that is always locked in conflict with the inner mind. We are so busy thinking that we can't know. We're so busy thinking and trying to analyze logically and see if it's possible the things that are not possible. Judaism begins where the impossible ends. We're a people that begin where the impossible ends. We begin where despair ends. That's who we are. You want to understand the Jewish people in terms of what's possible? You want to understand your work in the world in terms of what's possible? The Alter of Novadok used to say, ask not what is possible, ask only what is necessary. You hear that? You want to know what you should do in the world? Don't go out there and ask if it's possible. If you ask if it's possible, you've lost it from the beginning. Ask what is necessary. If it's necessary, go and do it. What's it got to do with you, whether it's possible or not? What's possible mean? We are so locked into the realm of what we think is possible that the only thing that is possible is what we think is possible. And we've already decided that nothing. So these three categories of being, understand, these three categories of being who aren't limited by their external faculties, yeah, they don't have a concept of what's possible and what's logical. They're not thinking like that. So the inner mind is open. It's absolutely right. You have to switch off the external mind. You want to deal with infinity, you have to switch off the external mind. That can't handle the concept of infinity. It can't handle the concept of faith. It can't even handle the concept that you know yourself. The outer mind is convinced that your knowledge of yourself is just some wiring, that's all. People like that have just passed a law in New Zealand giving civil rights to the great apes. You know that in New Zealand today, if you're an orangutan, you're very good luck because you now have civil rights. What are you laughing about? There's a move to do it in this country now. The problem isn't whether they should have rights. The problem is whether humans should. That's not the no problem with it. And there's a move now to move to lower animals as well, so-called lower animals. Why? Because in their notion, you're a biological organism, just like they are. So why should you have rights and not them? Why should you be able to dissect or perform research on animals if not on people? Why not? I'm not saying Judaism does not look favorably on hurting animals in any way. But the point is that there's a massive difference. And if you use the external mind, you cannot know it. You cannot know that difference. The Churban HaBayis, the real destruction of the temple, is a destruction of the tool itself. The tool that is known, first of all, to make contact with who I am. You can't move without that. Once I have a healthy grasp of who I am, in a common sense, first-hand, primary knowledge way. If you can't do that, there's no discussion. There can be no discussion of anything beyond that. We're not trained that way. In Western thinking, we get very uncomfortable. You mean I have to know that without any recourse to proofs? It's the only thing you can know. How can you develop this knowledge? How can you fight against the external world? The truth is that when you click into this, it's so obvious. Anyone who's had any experience with this, anybody who's psychologically basically more or less normal, halfway normal, when what is being discussed here is for a moment grasped, it is so obvious and so easy and so simple. What are the exercises or experiences in life that make this clear? There are two experiences in life, if you need them, you shouldn't need this. But if there are two experiences in life that make it clear, one is abject terror, total blinding fear, and the other is the ecstasy of being about to die and surviving. When you're going through a terrifying experience where you think you might not survive, at that moment there's no calculating faculty of whether I am or am not existing. At that moment, if you're traveling across the Atlantic at 35,000 feet, and you're having a learned debate with yourself about whether you existentially exist, you know, whether you're here or not. And suddenly the plane starts to shake very badly, very badly. Try at that moment, you know, taking the existential position that you actually don't exist and therefore there's nothing to worry about. Try doing that. Because at that moment all that happens is your consciousness is flooded with awareness of don't let me die or my child, which is an extension of the same thing. Of course, you have to understand we're not talking about the emotion. The confounding variable here is the emotion, is fear. But if you could subtract the fear, The knowledge of your own existence that you're left with is a very rich contact with the dais. And the other version of that is a time when you're about to die. For example, if you've ever had the unfortunate experience of being about to drown, you ever been caught under the waves in a position where you thought you couldn't ever, and suddenly and unexpectedly you break a surface and you take a breath. That first breath is an experience of pure dais. In that moment, you not only know you exist, you have an absolute and rich connection with your own life. In that moment, again, we have to subtract the emotion of elation. But what you're left with is the knowledge that you exist. Of course, it only lasts for a minute. 5 minutes later, you're getting bored again and making everyone's life around you miserable, and you need a new lesson, unfortunately. But it's only familiarity that takes away that ecstasy. And in fact, all pleasures in life, and the sharper the pleasures are, the more they do this, they stimulate nothing other than a sense of the knowledge of your own existence. That's what real pleasure is. Real pleasure is not that nerves are being stimulated. Real pleasure is that the heightened sense of actually being alive. In fact, the emotion naturally connected with the dais is the sense of life. And the emotion connected with a lack of dais, like you have, for example, in morbid depression, is a feeling of death. And that's because the most important thing that the dais knows is that I am and that I'm alive. Anyway, this is a long discussion, but very briefly, let's try and summarize. Putting a sword through the Kurdish Kadoshim and having blood come out, yeah, that means the center of the world, Ani Yishen of a Libi Eir, that heart that beats, that is awake even when we're asleep. Savash Haragas Atzmoy, that's what he thought he had managed to pierce, right? But the delicate use of language here, Atzmoy, what died at that moment, right? Nothing else, yeah, what died in that moment of banishing, as it were, of the spiritual core of the world, that real Atzmi of the world, that great Ani, which is the I. When Hillel came to the temple, he said, if I am here, everything is here. He didn't mean I. He was the humblest of all people. He meant if the great Ani is here, which I know through my knowledge of self. How does Emuna begin? How does Emuna begin? How do you begin the search for knowledge of his existence? You want to begin it at seminars where they give you external proofs? It's a good beginning. But that isn't knowledge. All that gives you is a weakening of the alternatives. All it does is show you that the world does not make a good case for its own random chaotic nature. That it's too highly organized and too precise and speaks too eloquently of a source that gave it existence. But what that source is, the seminar cannot help you with that. What that source is, for that you need you and Torah. Only an investigation of Torah, which is a journey into the inner mind, an opening of the inner mind, an opening of the dais, which is the most important faculty that there is, and the least popular. Only that journey is the one that can tell you. The consciousness is, first of all, by far the most important that I am. A rich, simple awareness of that. And then as you get a little bit more mature, you become aware that I am, but I'm not everything. I'm part of a greater context. And that context has no limits. And the source of that context, of which I am part, and with which I identify, that's what we mean by the beginning of discovery of what Hashem is. But it lives only in that private inner zone. In that world, you're alone. It's you and Hashem. There's nobody else in there. Completely alone. The way another can be included in that is only in a tremendous intensity of love, where that other individual becomes one and the same as you. This is the real meaning of a marriage, where the two members of the couple, two members of the marriage, become bonded into a oneness, and the only thing that is there with them alone is Hashem. Yeah, that's what man and woman generate together. It's that knowledge of Kedusha. It's in that inner sanctum of purity where two of them connect correctly. Not in that non-Jew's way, right? That he tried to demonstrate the breach of this idea. It's in that inner sanctum where the real Kedusha is generated, where two really become one, right? Where there's a sudden and amazing discovery that those two having become one are actually three. And that three is really the same one. And in that inner marriage, in the private mind, your own mind, which has to be you and your knowledge of yourself, there's also that silent third, which actually deep investigation shows is the, not the third, but the first. There are no words for these things. There are no words for these things. There's a meditational journey. That's what it has to be. The external mind has to be disciplined. It has to be developed. It has to be developed and disciplined. And it has to be used carefully to shine itself upon those things that can be, they can be experienced without. Your camera has a very useful tool. Camera is used for things that the camera can take pictures of. But when the camera is being skillfully used, the user has to be aware that there's something that can't be pictured. There has to be used another tool for that. And the tool that knows that is the thing itself. So perhaps what we can think about working towards in these 9 days is a journey that moves towards a point where there can be at least a little genuine mourning for something that we don't have anymore. You have to generate the emotion of being able to mourn for something that you lack, not even knowing that you lack it. But if we can do that, if we can generate a little bit of the pain that brings the awareness of the fact that there's a hollow echo where the mind should be. There's a hollow echo where Jews' mind should be, unfortunately. Right? There's very little of that left, just a vestige. There's hardly left the knowledge of my own existence without recourse to proofs and crutches and supports and an external world of busy noise and media telling me that I'm around. There has to be a silencing of all that. And in the silence of Tisha B'Av, where we do not communicate, right? We sit silent, we sit alone. This is the beginning of a consciousness generate. If we do that, Amir Tzashem, we can enter a summer where hopefully there will be the beginning of a flourishing of the genuine ani of the world. We can say we reach a point where we know what's called Atzmi.